Hi, I'm Dr. Selena Matthews, spiritual psychologist, and I want to welcome you all to Soul Transformation. My guest today is Dr. Seth Kadish. He is a psychologist, an educator, an author, and as if that wasn't enough, he is also a playwright. Our topic today is how your negative childhood patterns impact your future. This is going to be a very interesting and thought-provoking discussion, so please stay tuned. So excited to have you, Dr. Seth. So we're going to be talking on negative childhood patterns and how they impact your life. And this is going to be such an exciting topic because I think every single person can relate to this. So let's start with, what are negative childhood patterns?
Okay, well, first of all, thank you, Dr. Selena, for having me on. It's a pleasure, and I'm very excited to be talking to you about this, so thank you.
You're very welcome.
Negative childhood patterns. So we all have these negative patterns of thought, emotion, and behavior. And by the way, there's a sequence to it, which maybe I can comment on later. They typically start in early childhood, as early as one or two, and I say between ages 1, 2, and maybe 5 or 6. We really have this stuff implanted in us. We're not aware of it. We're little kids. Just to be a little lectury here for a moment, there are 5 categories. I'm sorry to be a little lectury, but maybe it's interesting to.
Yeah, okay. Educate us, please.
Okay. All right, the way I see it, and by the way, Dr. Selena, you know, the stuff is fairly simple at the heart of it. For everybody listening or watching, it's a pretty easy concept to grasp, which is important because without being condescending, I want everybody to understand and be able to educate people as to how these patterns get instilled and how, more importantly, they affect us right now as adults. Okay, so the 5 typical responses that we can have in our early childhood to our family of origin or anybody in our surrounding environment can be essentially, and by the way, no right or wrong, no good or bad, just simply how we react to our environment. We can be dominators, which is to say we can be aggressive and controlling in response to our environment. We can be submissive. We can be defensive. We can take flight, which is to say we can either kind of take internal flight, disconnect from our surroundings, sort of like the kid who is in a chaotic household who goes off in the corner and literally just blanks it all out, blanks what's going on around him or her, or we can become invisible. They're all simply ways of dealing with what is happening in our environment. So now with each category, within each category, there are a number of patterns which I'll talk about. And here is maybe the essential teaching about patterns work. They're not right or wrong. They are simply responsive. And the problem becomes that as we grow older, what worked, and I'm going to tell you, I have a little story I'd like to share in a moment. What worked for us at age 4 does not work well at 14, not at all at 34. And by the time we're 94, if we make it that far, you know, it's toxic.
Absolutely agree with you. And it's really hard to get that through to people because I work with the lifespan and I can actually see people playing out 4-year-old patterns in their 90s. And I'm like, no, this has got to change. And they go, well, I've been doing this all my life. No, you have to change.
Right. And the number, exactly, thank you. And the number one reason why we don't change it, we don't let go, is simply they're familiar. That's our self-identity. Something I might say to a depressed client without, again, trying to be insulting, very careful not to be, is this is what you know how to do. You know how to be anxious or depressed or shameful and so on. We all get it because we're all doing that. So how do we identify the pattern? And then what interventions can we utilize to start not getting rid of them, but decreasing them, decreasing the patterns?
Now, why don't you want to get rid of them?
Why would you want to get rid of them? Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. Good question. Excellent question. You know, the way I see it is negative patterns impact, detrimental to our detriment, they impact our ability to achieve goals in our current incarnation. And those are internal or external. Giving example. So maybe your internal goal is you want peace, serenity, confidence, calm. Well, it's your patterns that are going to prevent you from getting there. Or what I find typically, Dr. Salino, with many clients, and I've certainly been there myself, is we're very focused on external goals. And that could look like relationship and finance and career and money and all that. And when I look at the person's inability to attain that goal, I will always track it back to one or more negative patterns that they are simply not aware of, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, total sense. Absolutely. But sometimes it's hard to get people to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree right. with me there?
Wholeheartedly. Wholeheartedly. Let me, if I can, let me tell you a story.
Yeah,
I use this as I do a lot of patterns groups and workshops and trainings, and I use this as an introductory story. So I call it my world famous Little Jimmy story. It's not quite that world famous yet, but maybe.
Maybe it will be.
Maybe it will be. Let's hope. So this is not an actual story, but it's a composite of many clients I've worked with over the past 25 plus years. A little boy named Jimmy's 4 years old, and he is at home. It's the middle of the day, and he's with his big old golden retriever, Bucky. So Jimmy and Bucky, best of friends, they're at home. Now, Mom is in the kitchen, and Mom, not a happy camper, right? She's doing the dishes. She's wearing those gloves, you know, the dishwash gloves, smoking a cigarette, dangling out of her mouth. There's a half a bottle of wine already gone. It's 2 p.m. And, you know, poor Mom, she's got her own patterns, but clearly not having the happiest of lives. But the little boy, it's great, great little boy. All right. So Jimmy and Bucky are romping through the house. And when they get to the living room, he accidentally bumps into a little end table. And on the end table is Mom's favorite fragile vase. Vase hits the floor, boom, crash, breaks into a million pieces, and out comes Mom from the kitchen. Hears that noise, and Mom is holding a spatula in her hand, and she's not happy. Okay, so at this point, I will usually ask the clients in my group, what does Jimmy say to his mom? And the correct answer from my story would be, the dog did it. He blames the dog. I always tell people no dogs have been harmed in the telling of my story. They're absolutely fine. Dog's good. But his thinking is, look, worst comes to worst, I'm going to get hit, which happens to kids, unfortunately, or maybe less so, I'll get a tongue lashing. But either way, I'm in for it. Mm-hmm. So he blames the dog. Here is the problem. In that moment, that little boy has learned that manipulation and deceit and blame, all those negative patterns of thought, emotion, and behavior are good, and they are. That's how we all grow up. Those patterns are good. But the problem is when he's, 42 years old and he's blaming and lying in and manipulating, he's not having a good life.
Right.
So that's the thing. I always really want to go back in time, try our best to figure out why did I start avoiding, withdrawing, trying to be unheard and invisible. Where did it serve me? What were the benefits? And did the benefits, are they now outweighed by the consequences? And if so, there's my motivation to change. And that's my little Jimmy story.
Well, it's a great little Jimmy story. I think a lot of people can relate to it. And I think that's a perfect example where a child can learn how to manipulate, how to control the situation, how to, push blame elsewhere. And that continues throughout their life. And I do a lot of work on people who cheat. And there it is. That little scenario that you gave, it's very easy for people to lie. It's right. The dog did it. Oh, wasn't me in the car with the girl? No, it was somebody else.
Right.
It's the same pattern, but that can just set up a whole trajectory of life in the dark side of life, the shadow side of the human experience. But so I love that. That should be a classic in taught in every psychology school, believe me. So that's a beautiful story. Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, sure. Sure.
So what you're saying is patterns are learned from the experiences that people have. They're learned also through osmosis. Is there other ways besides those two ways that they're learned?
It's a really good question. It comes up a lot. Are patterns essentially modeled, or is there some innate quality to these patterns? My best guess, based on observation of clients, is typically they're learned. I suppose we could be born with a tendency or propensity to a certain kind of mindset or behavior, but usually I think it's reactive. And then that brings up another interesting question or point, which is, are patterns always modeled by the parent or parents? Or what I found a lot of times is they can be an opposite response to a parent's pattern. So just to kind of break that down, my dad might be aggressive, and I might say as a little boy, yeah, I'm going to be like Pop, I'm going to be aggressive too. Or what I've seen with clients, and I would say my own life as well, and I'd be curious about your own experience with that too, where we note a parent's behavior, even at that age of 3, 4, 5, because kids are smart. I mean, kids get it. And on some level, we say, I'm not going to be like that. Yeah. And the person grows up to be a very warm and friendly and loving adult with their own patterns, but they're not aggressive. So it really can go either way.
You know? No, absolutely. Yes, I think, I mean, how did you grow up? What were the patterns that happened to you?
Well, let's see. I would say, and by the way, I am very forthcoming with clients because I really like to make the point that these are universal. Every therapist, psychiatrist, teacher, spiritual person has either has them or has worked through them. Tell you what, I'm going to answer it, but before I do, I want to lay out what I think are the top four patterns in terms of being problematic and most frequent. And I'll give you a little hint. I have two of the four. So there we go.
I'm sure I have two or more.
Well, and the thing is, we all have so many of them. You know, we have so many. But the four in order, Dr. Selena, are number one. I'll start with number one, shame. Which is simply, as you know, I'm not good enough, I'm bad, I'm weird, I'm defective, I'm an alien. And the reason I put that at number one is because not only is it, there's a pandemic of shame in our culture, right? But it's the most lethal because as you do too, I work with a number of clients who are self-harming, suicidal, drug addicted, alcohol, or what I see with great frequency is people who practice, or rather don't practice, good self-care. And that to me often stems from shame. I'm not worth it. Why should I take care of myself? And it can be lethal. Number two are, linked codependency patterns of people-pleasing and caretaking. They both sort of stem from that same thing of I hurt me to help you, which by the way, took me 35 years of that is one of my patterns to come up with that little saying to describe what those patterns look like. I'm hurting me to help you financially, emotionally, however. Number three would be suppression of emotion. And number four is avoidance of all sorts. And that's just my own take on what I see as the top four problematic patterns. I grew up with a lot of shame. And I grew up with a good amount of codependency, placating a parent, placating adult figures. And I think maybe later we can get into interventions. I'd actually like to share a couple of very simple interventions with the people watching. But I think for me, share a couple.
Let's do it. Yeah.
Okay. I've got a good intervention for all those. And I would like to throw the question back at you, if that's okay. And what sure. patterns would you identify in your childhood?
Well, you know, I was the opposite of, I grew up in a very dysfunctional family where my mother was, you know, tended to be very sociopathic, but I did not know what that was at the time. But she wanted me to lie. And what I did is I refused to lie and I refused to tell my father certain things. So I would be physically abused because I wouldn't lie. So I made a choice at a very young age that I was not going to lie. Mm-hmm. And I hate lies. It's not, and it comes from that place of my early childhood, you know, and I paid dearly with consequences because I refused to lie. But like we all as therapists, and I agree with you, I think it's great to be honest about our experiences because we're leaders and in terms of the human experience, and every therapist has gone through all kinds of stuff because we couldn't do what we're doing and be successful without having, you know, stories where, you know, we had to work through.
Right. Work through. Absolutely. That's the operative phrase. Yeah. Because something else that clients will ask me based on what you just said is, well, are you still dealing with the patterns? And the answer is, yeah. Sort of like an addict in recovery, you can have 50 years of sobriety, but you're always vigilant because the pattern, like an addiction response can pop back up. I kind of compare it to whack-a-mole. Mm-hmm. And in times of stress or trauma, that pattern, you haven't been codependent in years, but all of a sudden, you're having a bad day, a bad week, it pops back up.
Dr. Seth, that is fantastic. That image, the Wacomo image, is the one I'm never going to forget. I love it because that's exactly what happens. You're fine. You do a piece of work or a client does a piece of work, and then all of a sudden, boom, it shows up. And it's like, where did this come from? I spent 5 years working on this 10 years ago. What right. happened? And what it's happened? Back again. Yeah, exactly. It's whack-a-mo. Thank you, Dr. Right. Seth. I'm going to use that whack-a-mo. You're in whack-a-mo mode.
and you know, I think it's very important too, which I tell clients, when it comes back up, and it surely might, don't shame yourself or berate yourself because it happens. It's sort of like somebody, I work with a number of people, I know you have as well, who have drug and alcohol issues, and they may have a slip or a slight relapse or even cravings. And like, it's okay. We understand. Just get back on the horse and address it. But don't berate yourself for that. It's human.
Yeah. No, yeah. Absolutely. I want to go back to shame. I think shame, and I love the way that you put it, Dr. Seth. Shame is a pandemic, and I've never heard it put that way. So I thank you for that, because that's a gift. Because I think if people don't face their own shame, they can't transform. I think if they can't look at themselves in the mirror and look at what they're ashamed of themselves about life, they cannot shift. There's no way they can shift without dealing with that layer of shame. That's what I think.
Well, I'm smiling because you actually literally, and you didn't know this, landed on my intervention. Okay. Wow. So I'm going to give it now to the viewers or listeners. So when I was really facing my shame pattern, I was very self-critical, lots of self-loathing, and I really wanted to break it, and I was looking for ways to do it. I was working with some wonderful people at the time, and I say this in a, you know, a gentle, humorous kind of way, because they were wonderful, but they were giving me very flowery kinds of affirmation. You are the loving essence of the beautiful lotus that descended upon the, and I always tell people, Dr. Selena, I'm from Brooklyn. That just didn't fly, you know? So my affirmation at that time was, and it's true, was I'm okay. Question mark. That was the best I could do because I had to get I couldn't go from shame to self-love, which is what everybody wanted me to do. I was able to fight my way from shame to self-tolerance, step along the way. And here is the exercise that I devised for myself, and I've taught it to many people. Guys out there listening or watching, it is on the face of it so simple and could be difficult to do. So what I would do is for 1 minute a day, 60 seconds, I would look in the mirror. You touch right on that. I would look only in my eyes, not at my hair, my chin. I don't want to find fault. I only want to make eye contact. As we know, right, that's the essence of who we are. That's our soul, so to speak. And I found it was really difficult at first. I would want to shy away. I couldn't really handle it. And it took me a while to be able to just to literally look in my eyes. The very first time I did it in a group setting, to my amazement, out of about 7 clients in the room, I had a big mirror and I had people do the exercise first time ever. I thought I would teach what I learned from myself. And one woman ran out of the room, I mean, upset, and another person started retching.
Really?
It was so difficult for them to literally look at themselves, and I understood it right away. So what I suggest that people do, again, 1 minute a day, try to do it a certain time of day, let's say 10 o'clock at night when you're getting ready to go to bed, whatever that may be, and do it minimally 30 days.
Wow.
30 days minimally, and then pay attention and see, is my shame, which I rated a 10, is it now maybe a 9.3? Is it starting to decrease? And just a quick word about that. I always tell people, don't try to get rid of your negative pattern, because it's not going away overnight. It took a long time to get it into place. And if it doesn't go away, you may either feel hopeless or down on yourself or depressed. But if you could make incremental shifts, you'll probably feel quite positive about yourself and the work you're doing. Yeah. So that would be my strong suggestion. 1 minute a day, mirror work.
Okay, got it. I love it. I've never heard that. I've never read about it. You need to write on this. This is really important. Maybe you have. I haven't read all your books. I just read this one, Popping Your Patterns, and it's really awesome. And we're going to continue because a lot of what we're talking on are on this book. So, wow, I love that. I'm going to actually do a 30-day test on that one.
Oh, great.
You know, because I love to learn. I love to learn different things and different techniques. Don't you, as a psychologist?
I don't want to jump the gun too much, but before we end, I'm going to maybe share a few pieces of wisdom. And one of them is right on point with what you just said.
Yeah. So before we go there, we're going to go there at the very end. I want to talk about, what is the difference between negative childhood patterns and transgenerational patterns? And can you give me an example of that?
Well, in a way, it's kind of part and parcel, because a negative pattern can be transgenerational. Going back to what I was saying before, Dr. Selena, so maybe my grandpa was... maybe he was very emotionally avoidant. He suppressed his emotions. My dad watched that, passed on to him, and I observed my dad, who I just loved to pieces, loved to bits, and took that on as well. And so, yeah, the childhood pattern could be passed along. But to go back to what I was saying a little bit earlier too, it can be broken somewhat intentionally, like your own example, where you said, I'm not going to be like my mom.
Right.
So, right. But it doesn't have to get passed along. The other thing that I share with clients is when you break your own patterns, in a sense, you are very likely breaking transgenerational patterns. You could be passing them along. And you're certainly breaking the link between you and your parents or whoever you modeled yourself after.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Dr. Seth. I like that a lot, because you don't know. I mean, some people don't know their, you know, grandparents or whatever, and they don't know the lineage. Some people do, some people don't. But there could be a combination of all of that, but it doesn't really matter essentially, because mm-hmm. it's about creating the future, not living in the past. And the people that live in the past don't want to change because they are stuck in the mud or locked in a cage or whatever image that you want. And they don't want to open the door and see life or see the world.
Right. Exactly right. It's a real threat to our self-identity, and fear of change, and particularly fear of changing our own self-image, is so frightening to people. And as you know, people are not aware of that fear. They're not even aware of their self-identity. People often just say, well, it's just the way I am and the way I'll always be. No, doesn't have to be.
Right.
Right. You know, if you're 6'5", you're probably always going to be that way. You might shrink when you get a little older, but, you know, but if you're a people pleaser or shame-filled or aggressive, you can absolutely shift that. Absolutely.
Yeah. Fear of change is a big one in practice. People don't want to change. They don't want to change. They have no desire. And it's such a struggle for them to do so. Why is it so difficult, do you think?
I think it's very difficult because it's so comfortable. It's so easy. It's so non-threatening to stay where we are. And I think we feel unmoored, like a ship kind of that's lost its mooring, which is floating, if we don't have that sense of self. You know, it's really a very difficult shift. I mean, as you were saying that, I was actually thinking of clients who, going back to the shame exercise, will get very excited about doing it, and they only do it for 3 days. They sabotage, right? You know, they sabotage their change, and then they'll come back and complain, well, I tried and I can't or I couldn't. But if we were going to sum it up in one word, it's resistance. That's all it is. And then as we explore it, we find out how threatening the change is. It's really, really threatening, you know?
Do you have any insight on how to inspire people to go through their resistance to get to the other side?
Besides threatening them, let me think for a moment. That's a joke. I'm joking. I don't do that. Part of it is something, and I suspect you might do this too. One reason why I am forthcoming about my own patterns work is to inspire people. Because sometimes people, right, they look at us, Dr. Celine, and go, oh, well, you're so advanced, or you're knowledgeable, you're wise, whatever nice words they may have for us, but they don't know what we've gone through.
Correct.
So that might be one way I do it, is to motivate and inspire through personal sharing. Let's see, what else? Again, going back to the goals, that if people have those goals and that's really the carrot being dangled in front of them, that can be a really good motivator, and they simply need to be reminded of, well, you wanted a relationship. You wanted more connection. And I think that works with a lot of people. I think just our encouragement and support, being there for people on whether daily or weekly basis, makes a big difference. I also encourage people, if you have a therapist, great, but do you have a best friend, a romantic partner? Sometimes they have a coach or a sponsor. And get everybody in your team to support you in that. And know that it could be difficult, but the ultimate reward will be worth it. And there are plenty of people who believe in your ability and desire to change.
Yeah, that's great. So what you're saying is community really helps to facilitate that, and telling people and admitting, look, I'm going to try to work on this quality. So let's get everybody around me to help me to, you know, push me along slowly. I think that's a great intervention, actually. Great intervention.
Yes, thank you. And speaking of interventions, going back to the shame one, what I find works best, maybe because in my own nature, I'm, believe it or not, a pretty simple person. Maybe it's the Brooklyn thing. I really am. And I like really simple interventions that are very easily understood and easily practiced. So to have a very simple intervention, to do it repeatedly, to have that supportive community around you, it's a pretty good recipe for success, I think.
Yeah, no, I really agree with you. I want to move on to something else right now. In reading your book, I was really inspired. I know you've done a lot of things with addiction, but one thing that I found really fascinating was your work in the prisons. And you worked with the most hardened criminals that exist. So I'm sure they had a lot of negative childhood patterns, and that had a big impact. And as I was reading your book, you were giving me different ideas about the criminal mind or the criminal experience. Can you talk more about what you have learned from that part of your career?
I think the problem is I can talk endlessly about it. So,
Another show.
I'm gonna edit my own self. You know what? I would like to, Dr. Celine, if you don't mind, I want to start with a shout out. Okay, I have a very dear friend, and her name is Fritzi Horstman, and she started a couple of years back something called the Compassion Prison Project. Amazing videos online. Look it up. She's literally got a couple of million hits at this point.
Wow.
And literally, her whole story is fascinating. That would be another conversation. But we've talked a lot about it. And the basic idea of her project is that all these inmates, and we're talking about maximum security prison, which is where I worked for almost 5 years, half time, that all of these people have had ACEs, which are adverse childhood experiences. And that could be parental abuse, neglect, addiction, depression, you name it. And so all of the inmates that I met, you could safely say, had experienced that growing up. So we're talking about working with trauma. And these men, absolutely great or maybe not so great examples of shame, really, really mired in the shame pattern, number one. What did I learn? I've learned so much. So, okay, now I gotta tell you another little anecdote.
Okay, good.
And okay, it has to do with when I was teaching on the graduate school level, and I was doing a group actually called The Criminal Mind. I did a couple of groups like that back in the day. And so it was a weekend course, Friday 6 p.m. to Sunday 3 o'clock. And when I had all the students in the room, let's say there were approximately 20, 25 students, I said to them, I'm going to give you what I think is the key or the essence of the criminal mind in one word. So now, after I give you that one word, you're welcome to leave for the weekend. I'll give you an A. Don't tell Dr. Celine anybody I said that, but I would give him an A, because clearly they were going to stay the whole time because people are fascinated by the criminal mind. And I let them guess what that one word might be. And some said anger, I think, and some said fear. They made a whole bunch of pretty good guesses. And I said, here's what I see as the key or the essence of the criminal mind. And the essence is immaturity. That was a huge learning for me. And what I mean by that is most criminals I ever work with, they had very childlike or childish thinking. I want that. I'm going to have it now. Instant gratification. There was no real consequential thinking, no thinking of others. They really, really approach life like little kids. And that was very helpful in guiding my work. Again, not to treat them as little kids, these were grown men, but to keep in mind that cognitively they were not highly developed.
Do you think that was about their IQ, or do you think that was more about what they learned in their childhood, or they didn't have, I mean, clearly they didn't have proper parenting, or they were left on their own, or they were abused, or can you narrow that down for me?
I actually can. I would say the majority of men, I'm going to make up a figure and say 80%, 90%, not IQ related at all, but more about how they grew up, whether it was poor parenting, neglect. And sometimes, you know, here's not to go too far afield, and I don't want to get really into diagnostics, but I saw a number of men who could be, were diagnosed with ADHD or learning disorders, because that will produce somebody who feels shamed and left out of the normal course of events, and so develops a poor self-identity, and then gets into maybe the gang or kind of that neighborhood mindset. And so that person will typically be very immature in their thinking. But a lot of them, yeah, I think it was their immediate surroundings that taught them that we just want something, we want it right now. I work with a lot of gang members, and they really, I hate to say it, they really had that mindset. And many of these guys were so bright, you know, and I met a number of guys that I was very connected with. And to be clear, I'm not saying that they should be let out of prison. I'm not saying they should be absolved of the responsibility of what they did, but a number of them were heartfelt and I felt were very redeemable. And if we could just kind of shift that immature thinking, I'll give you an example of immature thinking.
Yeah, please.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I heard this from a number of guys. Most of the men were in for very long stretches or life without possibility of parole, but some of them were going to be getting out in the relatively near future. And we'd have these pretty honest conversations and I'd say, well, what are you going to do? I don't know, which translated as I'm going right back into the criminal world. Sometimes they would BS me and they would say, well, you know, I'll get a job at McDonald's and blah, 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 blah. And then at some point they go, well, yeah, I don't really think so. But if you really had a mature mind, you would say, I'm going to do whatever I have to do to support my family, to stay out of prison and not head right back into that world without justifying by saying I have no choice, because you always have choice. Now, in fairness to the guys, I have to say that to be a parolee out there is a tough deal, and there isn't a lot that I think is being done for them. I think in that sense, that's very accurate. That is very difficult to get out of prison and make your way in the world. I will grant them that. But again, to me, somebody with a real adult mindset would figure out, well, how can I do that and how can I suffer? Because children don't want to suffer, you know? And then the irony being that the guy with a wife and three kids who is going to go back and, you know, sling cocaine or do whatever they're doing, get back in the gang world, their justification to me is I have to get back in that world to take care of my family. And I would literally scratch my head and say to them, but there's a good chance you're going back to prison and then you won't be able to take care of your family.
Right.
Which is met by no response at all. So.
Wow. Wow. Wow.
Like I said, I could go on. I'll stop there.
No. But so what you're saying is, again, going back to the topic, you know, how the negative patterns impact your future. Their negative patterns were at a higher level degree. And so, boom, they landed in jail. Other people. So it is the process just a different intensity? Because people, you know, is that what you're saying in terms of regular people and people who are in penitentiaries? Is it just the intensity of difference? Or what is it that creates that, like, what will make someone go into a penitentiary versus another person not? Is it the intensity, or what is the other X factor?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think intensity is very right on, right? Because it's much more pronounced with that kind of person. I think that certain patterns, and I really thank you because I really hadn't thought about this, but as I stop and give a little thought, I think there are certain patterns with the inmate that are very prevalent. Justification, which is part of the defense category. Denial is a big one as well. They'll justify and deny their actions to the nth degree, whereas I'll call that person a civilian, probably wouldn't have it anywhere near that degree, right? You have to be able to justify the behaviors and actions, negative actions that you're doing. So intensity, absolutely, and more certain patterns probably showing up more than others, which is very interesting, I think. That would be a whole paper or book right there. So, you know,
Well, I think you're right, fourth or fifth or sixth book. I don't know. You've got a lot going down, I'm sure. So you have, by the way, again, Popping Your Patterns, the book that we're, you know, talking about is fabulous. So thank you. Really, really important. And it's a book that I'm going to suggest to a lot of my clients.
Thank you.
You know, so really well done. So I know you have some ways of motivating people, because I'm always, you know, as a therapist, I'm always looking for ways. And some people, as you know, are more difficult than others. And and we struggle with those because they are locked in an intransigent cement, and they're not moving no matter what, you know. And it's sometimes it's hard for me. Because I can't move them. I try a million different things and they don't move for a while. I mean, eventually they'll move, but it's just staying with them for the 1 or 2 or 3 years because they're just that intransigent. So right. what are the suggestions that you have for regular people and intransigent people?
Okay. Well, we were talking about motivation before, so I don't want to be repetitive, but I actually had mentioned that I have a couple of specific techniques or interventions, and that may be helpful. I shared the shame intervention, the mirror work, and I'd like to give two suggestions, one for the codependency patterns, which, you know, Dr. Selena, you can open your window there and throw a rock out and probably hit somebody with that pattern, because we know how common that is. Again, I raised my own hand. I have a very concrete suggestion about how to intervene with that one. And also the suppression of emotion. Actually, I have a good intervention for virtually everything. So, all right. With people pleasing, this is what I learned for my own self. Now, the simplest intervention, but hard to put into practice for people, they could do it with you as the therapist or me, but typically hard is simply to say no as appropriate. I mean, that's really the thing to do. But people may struggle with that. So here is something that I developed for myself that I'll share. So let's say that Dr. Selena, you say to me, hey, can you do me a favor? I need $1,000. I need it right now. So the old me would be reaching into my pocket before you had finished the sentence, you know? And not only that, but I would say to the person behind me, because I don't have the thousand, hey, John, can I borrow it for you to give to Dr. Selena? Which is kind of crazy thinking. So how did I break that? A very simple intervention is pausing. So here's what I would now do. You ask me for the $1,000 and I say to you, and by the way, of course, it's perfectly fine to just say no in a nice way on the spot. But let's say I'm entrenched in that pattern of, right, use the word intransigent, entrenched. I would then say to you, you know, Dr. Selena, it's 11 o'clock in the morning now. Let me get back to you by 5 o'clock today. Now, if you say to me, I have to have it right now, then I would say to you, you know, I'm sorry, I can't do it. But what that pause does, it enables me to number one, think, do I have the money? If I have it, do I want to give it to you? What are you using it for? I might not be inclined to do it. I'm going to think about my famous maxim, I hurt me to help you. Am I hurting myself? Yeah, I don't have that kind of money. So pausing and then keeping your word and revisiting it later is very, very effective. And sometimes the person will say, you know what, I already got the money, no worries. And then, right. Of course, it gives you time to prepare what you want to say. The key to that, of course, is I know back in the day that when I had to say no to somebody, I would be all over the map. I'd say, well, you know, Dr. Selena, I really can't, and I'm sorry, but, you know, World War I broke out. And then, I mean, just craziness, right? It pours out of us because we feel so guilty about saying no. So that's one technique. And while I'm in the technique giving mode here.
Yeah, good. No, I think this is really great. I think this is really informative for the people watching And also for me, I learn from everybody, don't you? Every single person, I'm learning from you today. I love this because it's always amazing. You just never know enough.
We're always reading. We're always talking. We're always learning. Absolutely. So one more intervention that I did for myself years ago, and it's really great for suppressing emotions, but it also turns out to be fantastic for shame. And I did it because I had bad, I'll call it maybe denial, unwillingness to look at myself, right? So here's what I did. Now, this was back in the day, almost before the age of computers and certainly cell phones, because this can be done on a computer or a cell phone. I did it in a notebook. I went out and I got a big 300-page blank notebook, and I called it my honesty journal. And I wrote in that book every day, and I began each sentence, "The truth is." And I started writing my deepest, darkest stuff. I also, to my surprise, and I'll give an example, wrote some really light stuff and a lot of neutral stuff. I got into the habit, self-deception was the pattern that I wanted to name. I got into the pattern, the habit of telling myself the truth. And it was so good for knocking down various negative patterns. So you'll appreciate this because I know you're expert in Jungian psychology. So it was really a dive into the shadow material, which could be violent or sexual, or things that we don't want to look at. Because if my self-image is I'm a nice person, I mean, who wants to look at that stuff, right? But it was helpful to tell myself the truth. And an example, by the way, without getting into the dark stuff, we could let that be. Suffice it to say, I dove in there. But an example of something that was on the opposite end of the spectrum that I would deny myself was, the truth is, I really want to give my buddy Ricky a hug, but that's really weird. So we could have loving stuff that we suppress as well. And I kept that book for, year and a half, and intense work. And I locked it away in a closet, and I've never showed it to a therapist, a colleague, anybody. My joke would be that if it ever came to light, I'm not going to be able to run for president. That's, you know, off the table completely. Though maybe in this day and age, maybe you could run, but, I don't know. But it was so cathartic. And I tell people, do it on a locked computer file, do it in a notebook, and no need to show it to anyone. Tell yourself the truth. And a lot of people that I've counseled, I've suggested that they do it. They have done it, and they've been very successful with it.
Tell yourself the truth. I like that. That's a book title. Tell yourself the truth.
There you go. Tell yourself the truth.
Yeah, I love that. That's a great intervention. I love it. Just great. Now, as we're moving through this, there's two things. You were going to tell us a couple of stories, and we are coming to the end, and I want to also know the three takeaways that you have learned about life that you want to share with everybody. So I'll let you go through that.
Okay. My takeaways.
Your takeaways, and also if there's any more stories, you had earlier spoken about a couple of things that you wanted to bring up. If they're gone, let's move on.
Right.
Takeaways.
Well, you know where I paused was at some point I will write a book with all of the stories because I just, have them, so many of them. I think I'd like to do the takeaways. And one of them actually I have a little story. It's kind of a joke, but it's something I'd like to end with. I thought about it. Okay. The number one takeaway is going back to shame is accepting yourself. And a mantra that, again, I did for myself and I encourage people to do is I'm flawed and that's okay. Here's the thing. The shameful person thinks I'm flawed and it's not okay. I'm just bad for having these flaws. I'm miserable. I'm awful and terrible. But I know, Dr. Selena, when I look in the mirror now, I recognize all my flaws. I still have tendencies. I'll lose my temper. I'm impatient. If you don't believe me, you guys, write an email to my wife. She will testify to all that, I promise you. I'm careless. So I'm aware of my flaws and accept myself. Whereas in the days past, I would not. So I'm flawed and that's okay. The second one kind of goes back to the self-deception. And it's something that my dad, who is long past and is very close with my dad, I love my dad a lot. And he tried to correct me when I was a kid, as did my mom. I appreciate that now, of course. And my dad said to me when I was young, and then when I was an adolescent, and even as an older person, he said to me, son, you can bullshit the world, but don't bullshit yourself. By the way, that was one of the things that led me to the Honesty Journal. And I thought that that is so accurate. And I hadn't realized how much I had been self-deceiving. Going back to what you and I talked about earlier, we self-deceive because we don't want to change. We don't want to literally and metaphorically look in the mirror. And so I had done that my whole life, which was a surprise to me, because if you would have asked me, I would have said, oh yeah, I'm very honest with myself, but I wasn't. Don't lie to yourself. Even if you lie to the whole world, if you have different personae, going back to a little Jungian terminology there, play different roles in your life, okay, long as you're aware of it, which again, I did steal from Carl Jung. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the third one is my last one. And I said earlier when you're talking about learning, that was going to be my last takeaway, which I was going to kind of cap off with a little story. Be open to learning. And the antithesis of that would be the negative pattern of self-righteousness or arrogance. The self-righteous person, arrogant, can't tell me anything, versus the open person says, tell me, I really want to hear. So a little story about a newlywed couple. And the husband is that arrogant, self-righteous guy. And they're on a plane and they're heading to Hawaii for their honeymoon. So as they're on the plane, the husband says to the wife, you know, it's not Hawaii, of course, smugly. She says, everybody, no, of course, it's Hawaii. He says, no. It's actually pronounced Hawaii. And the wife says, no, come on. Everybody knows Hawaii. And they're going back and forth and he's very, you know, sure what he's saying. All right. Well, they get off the plane and they go down the little steps of the airplane to the, to the tarmac. And there is a little old Hawaiian man who has all these leis in sand and he's putting them on around the necks of the people getting off the plane. So as they get off the plane, the little Hawaiian man goes over to the wife and he presents her with the lei. And he goes over to the husband, puts the lei around his neck. And the husband says to the little old man, sir, how do you pronounce the name of your state? And the little old man says, Hawaii. And the smug, arrogant guy turns to his wife and says, see, I told you. And he says to the little old man, thank you. The little old man says, you're welcome.
There you go. Oh, my God. That is fabulous. What a great, beautiful, sweet story.
A great little story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Seth Kadish, you are amazing, and it's been such a pleasure to sit and talk about therapy with you today. I have learned a lot, and I'm very grateful that you agreed to be on Soul Transformation. Thank you so very much.
And thank you back, Dr. Selena. A pleasure, a lot of fun. Always great to talk to you, and I appreciate you giving me the chance to talk about patterns work. Very appreciated. Thank you.
You're welcome.